Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today, well, it's pretty focused. We're diving into Dr. Hoffman's lecture on ecology. Specifically, we're tackling that really crucial concept of interactions between species, you know, interspecific interactions.
Yeah, this is absolutely fundamental. I mean, ecology is the study of how organisms interact with their environment, and a huge part of that is how they interact with each other.
Exactly. And Dr. Hoffman kicked it off perfectly, asking, you know, how does one species actually affect another?
And his opening example was great, wasn't it? Not predator-prey, but that crab picking up a sea urchin.
Yeah, using it like a spiny shield. It's such a vivid image, a walking defense.
It really sets up the core question right away. Okay. The crab clearly benefits, right? Plus for the crab, it gets protection.
Sure.
But what about the urchin? Is it being harmed, moved around, maybe missing food? That's a minus? Or is it unaffected, a zero? Or maybe it even gets some tiny benefit we don't see.
That's the framework, isn't it? That simple plus, minus, or zero. It's the shorthand Dr. Hoffman uses for everything that follows.
Right. The symbols for benefit, harm, or neutrality.
Okay, let's jump into those categories. The notation's pretty straightforward, but the interaction that really stands out, the one natural selection just works so hard against, is competition. That minus minus?
Yeah, the only one where both species lose out, it's fundamentally detrimental.
Because they're fighting over the same limited thing, right? Food, yeah. Sunlight, space, whatever it is.
Exactly. It costs energy, reduces fitness, lowers survival chances. It's just bad news for everyone involved. That's why nature tends to favor ways to avoid it.
Then we get the more familiar exploitation ones, the plus-minus interactions. Predation is the obvious one. One animal kills and eats another.
Classic plus-minus.
Yeah.
But Dr. Hoffman made a really important distinction with herbivory.
Ah, yes. Eating plants or algae. Still plus-minus, but different.
Critically different in outcome, usually.
Yeah.
The plant is harmed, definitely receives a minus, but it often isn't killed outright like in predation.
Right. It can often recover and keep growing. So it's still exploitation, still a plus for the herbivore and a minus for the plant, but maybe less final.
Less final and probably much more common across the planet when you think about all the grazing and browsing going on.
Okay. So we've got minus, minus, and plus, minus. What about the win-win, mutualism, the plus, plus? That falls under symbiosis, right? Which just means living together closely.
Correct. Symbiosis is the umbrella term for close interactions, and mutualism is the plus plus version.
Mm-hmm.
And that acacia tree and ant example Dr. Hoffman used, that's just textbook perfect.
It really is. The tree gives the ants shelter, like little homes in its thorns and food packets. Clear plus for the ants.
And in return, those ants are like a tiny, ferocious army. They attack any herbivores trying to eat the tree, and they even chew away competing plants near the base.
So the tree gets protection and less competition for sunlight and nutrients. A definite plus for the tree, too. It's a fantastic ecological deal.
A co-evolved partnership where both heavily invest in the other's success.
Now, what about the tricky one? Commensalism. The plus zero. Plus zero, where one benefits and the other is supposedly neutral. Dr. Hoffman seemed pretty skeptical about this one.
He practically called it a lie, didn't he? Or at least very hard to prove.
Yeah. The example was the buffalo and the egrets. The birds obviously benefit, snapping up insects. The buffalo stirs up, saves them foraging energy. Big plus for the egrets.
But is the buffalo really zero?
Really?
Truly unaffected? Maybe having insects flushed out is slightly annoying. Or maybe having some insects eaten off its back is a tiny plus.
Right. His point was that in any close interaction, finding genuine absolute neutrality is, well, probably impossible in the real world.
Exactly. We might label it zero if we can't easily measure an effect, but that doesn't mean the effect isn't there, however small.
That's a key insight. Scratch the surface of a zero and you'll likely find a tiny plus or minus.
Mm-hmm. Almost certainly.
Okay, let's pivot a bit. From these individual interaction types to how they structure the whole ecosystem, competition, that minus-minus pressure, is key to understanding the concept of the niche.
Yeah, and a niche isn't just the address, like where a species lives. Dr. Hoffman defined it as the whole set of resources it uses.
Everything. Location, yes, but also food sources, temperature tolerance, water needs, nesting sites, the whole package.
And because direct competition over those resources is so costly, natural selection strongly favors species diverging, using slightly different sets of resources, basically carving out their own unique niche.
Which leads to that critical distinction Dr. Hoffman made between the fundamental niche and the realized niche.
Right. The fundamental niche is sort of the dream scenario, all the resources a species could theoretically use if there were no competitors or other limitations.
But the realized niche, that's the reality. That's the portion of the fundamental niche it actually occupies and uses, often constrained by interactions with other species.
And that barnacle experiment he showed was just a perfect illustration. He had two species, one living higher up on the rocks, one lower down.
The brown ones and the blue ones.
Exactly. And the question was, could the brown ones live lower down too? Well, experimentally, when they removed the blue barnacles.
The brown ones immediately spread downwards into that newly available space.
Proving their fundamental niche included that lower zone. They could live there. But their realized niche was smaller purely because of competition from the blue barnacles.
It's such a clear demonstration of interspecific competition limiting distribution.
And it goes further. This pressure to avoid competition can actually drive evolutionary change. Think about those Galapagos finches Dr. Hoffman talked about.
Oh, yeah, the beak sizes. When two related finch species lived on separate islands,
their average beak depths were pretty much the same. They likely ate similar types of seeds.
But put them together on the same island.
Big difference. Over time, their beak sizes diverged significantly. One species evolved larger, deeper beaks for cracking tough seeds, while the other evolved smaller beaks, specializing on smaller, softer seeds.
That's character displacement, right? They physically changed to minimize competition.
Precisely. The evolutionary pressure to avoid that minus-minus interaction was so strong, it altered their morphology to specialize on different parts of the resource spectrum. Amazing.
It really is. Okay, speaking of avoiding negative interactions, let's talk defenses, specifically against predation. Coloration came up.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman highlighted two main strategies. First, cryptic coloration, basically camouflage.
Blend in, don't get seen. Like that frog melting into the leaf litter on the slide.
The exact opposite strategy is aposematic coloration. This is warning coloration. Think bright reds, yellows, oranges, blues on things like poison dart frogs.
It's an advertisement, isn't it? I am dangerous or taste awful. Don't even try it.
Absolutely. It relies on predators learning to associate the bright color with a bad experience.
Which leads perfectly into mimicry. The art of deception. Batesian mimicry sounds fascinating.
It is. That's where a perfectly harmless species evolves to look like a dangerous or unpalatable one.
Like that harmless caterpillar Dr. Hoffman showed that looks astonishingly like the head of a venomous snake and even mimics its defensive movements and hissing.
Incredible, isn't it? It's bluffing its way to survival, borrowing the reputation of the actually dangerous species. The predator avoids it because it thinks it's the harmful one.
But that only works if the predator has encountered the real dangerous one first.
True, which is why Mullerian mimicry is arguably more effective, ecologically speaking.
That's where multiple actually harmful or unpalatable species evolve to resemble each other.
Exactly. They all converge on a similar warning pattern. Think of different species of toxic butterflies or stinging insects having similar black and yellow stripes.
So they create a shared reinforced warning signal. Any predator that learns to avoid one learns to avoid them all.
It strengthens the signal for everyone involved. It's a kind of mutual advertising of danger.
Okay, all these interactions, competition, predation, defense, mimicry, they all depend on energy flowing through the system. Which brings us to the base, the producers.
The autotrophs. Plants, algae, some bacteria. Dr. Hoffman stressed their unique and absolutely critical role, carbon fixation.
Right. They're the only organisms that can take inorganic carbon dioxide from the atmosphere
and convert it into organic compounds, like sugars, using energy from sunlight or chemicals. That's the foundation.
Because every other organism, the consumers or heterotrophs, has to get its organic carbon by eating other organisms.
We all rely ultimately on that primary production. And while we often think in simple food chains, Dr. Hoffman emphasized that reality is a much more complex food web.
Yeah, that slide showing the web was intricate. Lots of interconnected pathways. And his point about humans being high-level consumers
makes our position, as he put it, potentially precarious or dangerous if the lower levels of that web are disrupted. We depend on the stability below us.
Which highlights the importance of certain species that have an outsized impact. Like keystone species.
Yeah, not necessarily the most abundant species, but one whose presence is crucial for maintaining the structure and diversity of the community, like the keystone in an arch.
Remove it and things start to fall apart. The classic example is the sea star, right?
The Pisaster sea star in the intertidal zone. It preys on mussels. Seems simple enough.
But when researchers experimentally removed the sea stars,
the mussels, freed from their main predator, completely took over. They outcompeted almost everything else. Barnacles, algae, other mollusks. Biodiversity plummeted.
So the sea star, by keeping the dominant competitor in check, actually allows more species to coexist. Its impact is huge, way beyond its numbers.
Absolutely critical. And then there's another special category Dr. Hoffman mentioned, the ecosystem engineer.
These are species that physically modify the environment?
Exactly. They change the actual geography or structure of the habitat itself. The beaver is a quintessential example.
Building a dam. It's not just interacting with other species, it's changing the landscape.
Totally. It transforms a flowing stream ecosystem into, well, at least two distinct habitats, the still water pond behind the dam and the alternate flow downstream. This changes everything for all the other organisms living there, creates new niches, eliminates old ones.
That's a powerful role. Okay, shifting gears slightly, let's talk about how we measure the overall health or state of these communities. Biodiversity.
A crucial concept. And Dr. Hoffman reminded us it has two main components. First, species richness.
Which is simply the number of different species present in an area. Easy enough.
But the second component is just as important. Relative abundance.
Right. It's not just how many species, but how evenly represented they are. You could have two forests each with 10 tree species.
But if forest A is 95% one dominant species, and forest B has a more even mix of all 10.
Forest B is considered to have higher overall biodiversity and is likely more resilient, more healthy.
Definitely. And this ties into a really interesting, maybe counterintuitive idea. The intermediate disturbance hypothesis.
This one surprised me, the idea that biodiversity isn't highest in the most stable environments.
Exactly. The hypothesis suggests that biodiversity actually peaks at intermediate levels of disturbance, things like storms, fires, floods.
How does that work? Too much disturbance seems obviously bad.
It is. If disturbances are too frequent or too severe, many species just can't survive or recover. Species richness drops.
Okay.
But if there's too little disturbance over long periods, the best competitors gradually take over all the available niches and resources. They exclude less competitive species.
Ah, so stability leads to competitive exclusion, reducing diversity over time.
Right. So that intermediate level disturbances that are frequent enough to open up some space and resources, knocking back the dominant species a bit, but not so severe that they wipe everything out, that allows the greatest variety of species to coexist. It creates opportunities.
That makes sense. Oh. It keeps things dynamic. And the recovery process after a disturbance, that's succession, right?
Yes. And Dr. Hoffman differentiated between secondary and primary succession. Secondary succession is what happens after a disturbance that leaves the soil intact.
Like the Yellowstone fires he mentioned. Even though the fire was intense, the soil remained with seeds, roots, microbes. Life was still there to restart the process.
Exactly. Recovery starts from an existing biological base. But primary succession, that's starting from almost nothing.
Like after a glacier retreats, scraping the land down to bare rock, or a volcanic eruption covers everything in sterile lava.
Precisely. There's no soil, no existing seed bank. Life has to colonize from scratch. And this absolutely relies on pioneer species.
Like lichens, that amazing symbiotic partnership between a fungus and an alga or cyanobacterium.
They're often the very first arrivals. They can cling to bare rock, slowly break it down chemically and physically, and when they die, they contribute the first tiny bits of organic matter to create the beginnings of soil.
Paving the way for mosses, then grasses, then shrubs, and eventually trees, it's an incredibly slow process built from the ground up, literally.
It can take centuries or millennia, which really underscores the impact of major disturbances, especially human-caused ones, Dr. Hoffman noted, like trawling, dragging nets across the seabed. It resets succession.
And destroys complex habitats that took ages to develop. He also touched on patterns of biodiversity, like the island effect.
Yeah, the observation that larger islands generally support more species than smaller islands. It applies to ecological islands, too, like mountaintops or oases.
Why is that? Less space means more competition.
Less space, fewer available niches, smaller population sizes which are more vulnerable to extinction, and often lower habitat diversity on smaller islands. It all points to area being a major factor in supporting biodiversity.
And also water availability, especially on land. That map showed a clear correlation between rainfall and vertebrate species richness.
Absolutely. Wetter areas, particularly the tropics, just support more life, more primary productivity, and ultimately more species richness.
Wow. So pulling it all together from Dr. Hoffman's lecture, it's this incredibly complex dance. Competition driving niche separation, predation shaping defenses, mutualism creating partnerships, keystones holding it together, engineers reshaping it, disturbance resetting parts of it.
It's a dynamic, interconnected system. And understanding these interactions, as Dr. Hoffman concluded, isn't just academic. It has direct relevance to us.
Right, like figuring out disease transmission. He mentioned Lyme disease.
Yeah, initially they blamed the wrong mammal, but understanding the specific host-parasite relationships, the ecology of the ticks and their preferred hosts, was crucial to identify the primary reservoir species, the white-footed mouse in that case.
Or tracking things like avian flu, needing to know which bird species interact, migrate together, share habitats. It's all applied ecology.
It really is. Understanding these interspecific connections is vital for conservation, resource management, and even human health.
Absolutely. So let's circle back to that thought about commensalism, the plus zero. If Dr. Hoffman is right, and true neutrality is maybe functionally impossible, maybe just an artifact of our inability to measure tiny effects, then does zero actually exist in nature? Is every single interaction, no matter how subtle, ultimately a tiny push or pull, a micro negotiation affecting both parties, even if we can't see it?
That's a fascinating question, isn't it? Is everything connected, influencing everything else, even infinitesimally? Something for you to ponder next time you're observing the natural world.